High up the wall, on a level with the head of the great god Osiris, the god of the river Hapi looked down upon them. Hapi was an hermaphrodite, with the breasts of a woman and the genitals of a man protruding from under the pendulous belly. The mouth in his hippopotamus head gaped wide to display the great curved tusks that lined his cavernous jaws. Standing on a pile of ammunition boxes, Nicholas was able to reach the Hapi image at the full stretch of his arms. As he touched it, he exulted. "This one's raised also." "The river flows towards the earth," she called up to him. "It must move downwards. Try it, Nicky." "Give me a chance to clear the edges." He used the point of the blade to chip the outline of the god free, and then he probed the plaster beneath it and found another vertical slot running towards the floor. "Ready to give it a go now?" He folded the knife and tucked it back into his pocket. "Hold your breath and say a little prayer for me," he instructed. He settled both hands on the image of the god and began to pull steadily downwards. Gradually he brought more pressure to bear upon it until he was hanging all his weight on it. Nothing moved. "Oh, it's not working," he grunted. "Wait," she ordered. "I'm coming up." She scrambled up onto the boxes behind him and placed both arms around his neck. "Hang on tight," she ordered. "Every little bit helps, I suppose," he agreed, as she lifted her feet and hung her full weight on his shoulders. "Yes, it's moving," he shouted. Suddenly the image of Hapi gave way under his hands, and with a sharp grating sound travelled down to the bottom end of the groove in the wall. Nicholas lost his grip on the smoothly rounded shape as it came up hard against the end of its slot. The stack of boxes under them toppled, and both he and Rayanne dropped back to the floor of the gallery. She was still hanging around his neck, and he lost his balance as she pulled him over backwards. The two of them sprawled on the agate floor in an untidy tangle of arms and legs. Nicholas scrambled to his feet and pulled her up beside him. "Oh, what's happened?" she gasped, looking up wildly at the damaged Hapi figure and then around the walls of the gallery. "Nothing," he said. "Nothing's moved." "Perhaps there is another..." she began, but broke off at a sound from the roof above them. They both stared upwards, startled and filled with sudden trepidation. There was a ponderous movement from above the high plastered ceiling. "What is that?" Rayanne whispered. "There's something up there. Sounds like a living thing." A giant was moving, coming awake after slumbering for thousands of years, stretching and turning as he awoke. "Is it..." She could not finish the question. She had an image in her mind of the great god himself stirring in a hidden chamber in the rock, opening those baleful slanted eyes, rising on one elbow to discover who had disturbed him from his eternal sleep. Then there was another sound, a creaking and rumbling, as though the arm of a mighty balance was swinging slowly across as its equilibrium altered. Slowly at first, then louder. The movement gathered momentum, like the beginning of a mountain avalanche. Then there was a report like the shot of a cannon. A crack appeared in the high ceiling, running the length of the gallery. Dust smoke from the jagged opening, and then, slowly as a nightmare, the roof began to sag down over where they stood. Both of them were paralysed with superstitious horror, unable to tear their gaze from the slow, inexorable collapse of the ceiling upon them. Then a chunk of plaster struck Nicholas's upturned face, slamming into his cheek, tearing the skin and sending him staggering backwards against the wall. The shock and pain aroused him at last. "The warning!" he blurted. "Taita's warning! The wrath of the gods!" He sprang to her side and grabbed her hand. "Run!" he pulled her after him. "Taita has booby-trapped the roof!" They raced back along the gallery towards the opening in the sealed entrance. Lumps of stone and plaster began to rain down, and dust filled the passageway, half-blinding them. The dull rumble overhead became a rising roar as progressively the roof collapsed. They did not dare to look back as the thunder of falling masonry swept towards them, threatening to overtake and overwhelm them before they were able to reach the entrance. A jagged piece of rock as large as her head struck Rayanne a glancing blow on her shoulder, and her legs sagged under her. She would have gone down if he had not flung one arm around her and held her upright, dragging her along the gallery. The dust obscured the passage ahead of them, so that the square opening that offered their only chance of escape receded in the choking fog. "Keep going!" he yelled at her. "Almost there!" As he spoke, A thick sheet of plaster came crashing down and smashed into the tripod stand of the flood lamp. Instantly, the gallery was plunged into utter darkness. Completely unsighted, Nicholas's first instinct was to come up short and try to orientate himself, but all around him the rubble of the roof was falling heavier and faster. He knew that at any second the entire roof would come down on top of them, burying and crushing them. Running on without a check, he dragged Royan along behind him in the darkness. He reached the end wall at full tilt, and the impact knocked the breath out of him. Now, through the swirling dust cloud, he was just able to make out the rectangular opening in the plaster wall in front of him, backlit by the lamps on the landing at the head of the staircase, outside. As he reeled backwards, he seized Ryan around the waist and lifted her bodily off her feet. He hurled her through the opening and heard her cry out as she fell heavily on the far side. Another piece of rubble struck him on the back of his head and knocked him to his knees. He felt himself teetering on the very brink of consciousness, but crawled forward, groping frantically, until he touched the jagged edge of the opening. With this handhold, he was able to drag himself over the sill, just as the full weight of the roof came thundering down along the entire gallery. Here, on the upper landing of the staircase, Royan was crouching on her knees. She crawled towards him, guided once more by the lamplight.
Are you all right? She panted.
A trickle of blood snaked down her cheek from a wound in her scalp line. It cut a dark, glistening runnel through the caked white dust that powdered her face. He did not answer, but dragged himself to his feet and pulled Royan up beside him.
"Can't stay here," he croaked,
just as a thick white breath of dust blew through the mouth of the opening and swept over them, choking them and dimming the flood lamps to a faint glimmer.
"Not safe."
He pulled her away from the opening.
"The whole thing might cave in."
His voice was rough, his throat closing with the dust. He dragged her to the head of the steps, and they staggered down together, stumbling against each other, their feet sliding under them as they came onto the algae slippery footing. Through the dust mist ahead of them loomed the broad, square figure of Sapper.
"What the bloody hell is going on?"
he bellowed with relief as he saw them.
"Give me a hand here,"
Nicholas yelled back at him. Sapper lifted Royan in his arms, and together they ran back down the tunnel, only stopping to draw breath when they reached the causeway over the sinkhole. The post office in the village of Debra Mariam was a small building in the dusty street behind the church. Its walls were of unplastered, unburnt and unpainted brick, and its galvanized iron roof glared like a mirror in the high mountain sunlight. The public telephone should have been in its booth outside the front door. However, the instrument had long since vanished, stolen, vandalized, or more likely removed by the military to prevent it being used by political dissidents and rebels. Tessé had expected this, and hardly glanced into the booth before she strode into the small room, which was the main post office. It was filled with a motley crowd of peasants and villagers, queuing to conduct their leisurely business with the elderly postmaster, the only person behind the barred counter. Some of the customers had spread their cloaks on the floor and settled in for a long wait, chatting and smoking while their children romped and crawled around them. Most of the patient crowd recognized Tessé as soon as she entered the room. Even those who had waited most of the morning in the lines at the counter greeted her respectfully and stood aside to allow her to go to the head of the queue. Despite two decades of African socialism, the feudal instincts of the rural population were still strong. Tessé was a noblewoman, and she was entitled to this preference. "Thank you, my friends," she smiled at them and shook her head. "You are kind, but I will wait my turn." They were embarrassed by her refusal, and when the old postmaster leaned over the countertop and added his insistence to the others, one of the older women seized Tessé's arm and forcefully propelled her forward.
"Jesus and all the saints bless you, Waizira Tessé."
The postmaster clapped his hands in respectful greeting.
"Welcome back to Debra Mariam. What is it that your ladyship desires?"
The entire clientele of the post office crowded around Tessé so as not to miss a detail of her transaction. "I want to make a telephone call to Addis," she told the postmaster, and there was a hum of comment and discussion. This was an unusual and important business indeed. "I will take you to the telephone exchange," the postmaster told her importantly, and donned his official blue cap for the occasion. He came around the counter, shouting and hectoring the other customers, pushing them aside to make way for Lady Sun. Then he ushered her through to the back room of the building, where the telephone exchange occupied a cubicle the size of a small lavatory. Tessé, the postmaster, and as many of the other customers who could find standing room, pushed their way into the tiny room. The exchange operator was almost overcome by the honour being accorded him by the beautiful Tessé, and he shouted into his headset like a sergeant major commanding a flag party. "Soon now," he beamed at Tessé, "only small delay. Then you speak to British Embassy in Addis." Tessé, who knew well what a small delay constituted, retired to the front veranda of the post office and sent for food and flasks to be brought from the village Tej shop. She treated her escort of monks, together with half the population of Debra Mariam, to a happy picnic, while she waited for her call to be patched through half a dozen antiquated village exchanges to the capital. Thanks to the Tej, spirits were high amongst her entourage, when, finally, an hour later, the postmaster rushed out to tell her proudly that they had succeeded, and that her party was awaiting her on the line in the back room. Tessé, the monks, and 50 villagers followed the postmaster back into the exchange and crowded jabbering into the cubicle. The overflow backed up into the main post hall. "Geoffrey Tennant speaking." The upper-class English accent was tinny with distance and static. "Mr. Tennant, this is Waisiero Tessé." "Oh, I was expecting your call." Geoffrey's voice lightened as he realised that he was talking to a pretty girl. "How are you, my dear?" Tessé passed Nicholas's message to him. "Tell Nicky it's as good as done," Geoffrey acknowledged, and hung up. "Now," Tessé addressed the postmaster, "I want to place another call to Addis, to the Egyptian embassy." There was a buzz of delight from her audience when they realised that the entertainment was not yet over for the day. Everybody repaired to the veranda for more Tej and conversation. The second call took even longer to connect, and it was after 5 o'clock when Tessé was at last put in contact with the Egyptian cultural attaché. Had she not once met him at one of those ubiquitous cocktail parties on the diplomatic circuit in Addis, and made a profound impression on him then, he would probably not have accepted her call now. "You are very lucky to have reached me so late," he told her. "We usually close at 4:30, but there is a meeting of the Organization of African Unity on at the moment, and I am working late. Anyway, how may I help you, Waisiero Tessé?" As soon as she told him the name and rank of the person in Cairo to whom Royan's message was addressed, his superior and condescending attitude altered dramatically, and he became effusive and eager to please. He wrote down everything she said in detail, asking her to repeat and spell the names of people and places. Finally, he read his notes back to her for confirmation. At the end of the long conversation, he dropped his voice to an intimate level and told her, "I was greatly saddened to hear of your recent bereavement, Lady Sun. Colonel Brusilov was a man I held in high regard. Perhaps when you return to Addis, you would do me the honour of dining with me one evening." "How kind and thoughtful of you," Tessé's tones were honeyed. "I would so much enjoy meeting your charming wife again." She hung up while he was still making confused noises of assent and denial.